First transmitting antenna system. After college, he studied for and received a first-class radio telephone license and began work in the Madison area as a field technician on GE two-way radio systems. In 1978, Rich began working as a staff engineer for WIBA Radio and was introduced to high-power FM by John Corsvet. In 1979, Rich and his wife, Joy, started Skyline Communications, specializing in antenna installations and tower construction. In 99, he sold the tower company, 20 winters was enough, and he opened up Resonant Results. The focus of this company is the development of broadcast transmission plants with testing and troubleshooting high-power antenna systems, a key component. Rich's bandwidth starts at AM radio and extends to the infrared frequencies. Please welcome Rich Wood, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, what a group. This is a great gathering. I'll tell you, it's an honor and a privilege to be felt to be part of this group. And Leonard Charles and the programming committee have just done a stellar job, as always, on bringing the clinic together. And I thank you for having me here today. The two areas that I wanted to talk about is the, are your antennas ready for the worst? And are you ready for 2012? Because regardless of our individual political beliefs, 2012 is going to be a huge year. I'm hearing there might be $2 billion spent on the presidential campaign alone nationally between radio, television, and print media. Missing a second will cost us. I spent last weekend to this end. I was in Iowa last weekend working with a station that's getting ready for 2012. It's a UHF Sigma Harris transmitter. And he split the cooling systems between the two tube cabinets because he wants to be on a 50% regardless. And one of the other things he was working on was taking the water-cooled reject load and the water-cooled dummy load and putting in buffers between them in the form of gas barriers. Because this fellow actually had two sites where water-cooled load blew a seal and the glycol got into the RF system. And when he went to the site to check on the outage, he found the door 20 feet away from the building. We normally think of glycol as a fairly inert product, but when it mixes with RF and a waveguide setup, it's very explosive. So this is part of him getting ready for 2012. But we're a factually based group, and that last presentation was wonderful with pure facts. And I just want to share with you, after 32 years of marriage, one of the facts of life that I have found, and I posted this on the refrigerator just so I recognize to my wife, we need signs. Women don't need signs. And then it was kind of hot last summer, and the weather department has a fun time. The weather department has a fun time with their graphics, but wow, that was bad. That was really bad. And, you know, you just try and take a day off and chill out and things like this come along swimming at you. That's when you know it's not going to get much better. But I did hear from Chuck. He was leaving Washington, D.C. a while back after one of his trips. And wow, this is what he saw out the window. He thought he could, you know, relax at this point. But there are some days that we're just hanging in there and hoping for the best. But he seems like he's got a good grip on the situation. At least we don't have this problem. You know, terrorists cutting our towers down and causing our infrastructure all kinds of havoc. But today's presentation, I wanted to touch on just preparing for the worst, about backup equipment and sites, AM antennas, FM antennas and de-icers, ice shields, and then a little bit about TV antenna systems and the rigid lines. This is how bad it gets. This is Joplin, Missouri last year. And fortunately, the broadcasters were on the other side of town and they were able to stay up and provide real-time information to the citizens that were affected by these tornadoes. I mean, 17 cell sites not just knocked down, they were destroyed. So our role, although we do a lot of entertaining, we do a lot of selling of advertising, we are got to be there for the public when we're needed. So even after Hurricane Irene, Julius Jenikowski had to eat a little crow and say the broadcasters provided an exemplary service to the general public. And that was supported by Gordon Smith. the earthquake that happened in D.C., the cell service was dead for an hour and a half because it was completely swamped and the internet was down. Again, we are there to provide the information in real time when it's required. But in 2008, there was a report made to Congress by the FCC that they don't feel that we have the resiliency of a rigorous emergency responder infrastructure. And this is written by someone that works 9 to 5, not like many of us that work from 5 to 9. And they don't live in our world, where sales calls you up when you're flooded out and asks you, oh, are we gonna be up for that remote this afternoon? You gotta make it happen now. And you don't have a book that you're gonna run to check for the answers. But it's all in preparation. And I really like that sentence that came out from the last presentation. You can expect what you inspect. Be prepared, have a plan. And the biggest asset we have in life is the people. So you need to share that plan with the people, with the staff, so everybody's on the same page. And the various places, the studio, the transmitter site, or other parts of your facility become involved in that plan. And the things that are involved in our systems, and that's what today's focus will be. Before an outage occurs, in a major storm situation, you want to be clear whether the station has business interruption insurance or not. And business interruption insurance, like any policy, has a deductible. But it's not in dollars, it's in time. It could be 10 minutes, it could be an hour, it could be a day, it could be a week. And as you increase the deductible, then the price of the policy goes down. But the owner and general manager, you need to ask them, how fast do you need this fixed? I've actually gone into sites where we ran in and played the heroes and got the station back on the air in jig time with an antenna problem and came down off the tower feeling like we just beat the world, and the general manager says, couldn't you have been 10 minutes slower? I'm like, what? Yeah, the business interruption insurance cuts in 10 minutes from now. Well, maybe if you'd told me that. But then you're getting into a collusion against the insurance company. But you as an engineer or station personnel would be best advised about that so you can gauge the action of your response and the contractor's response. A little bit about AC generators. We all know and love them, except when the mice move into them and chew them up and don't make them very viable. Having generators at every location isn't always preferred. And the cellular people have come up with a really spiffy deal. You'll see this a lot on these cell huts. There's one there, and there's one there. That's the plug for the generator. They actually have a portable generator that they drag around, so they don't have to have 50 generators at all their different plants. And for the smaller broadcast facilities, it just makes a lot of sense. You could have a generator on a trailer in the mouse-proof garage, ready to go for the studio, or for the AM site or the FM site. Or you can actually go to a rental company and have an ongoing agreement with them. So on a short notice, you can get them to provide you with a diesel or LP-fired generator and have the correct plug on it so you can just come and plug right in and get the station back up without a lot of, fooling around. This was an excellent auxiliary generator install that I ran into recently. They got the hot conductors insulated off the tower. But this runs from the generator hut over to the main building. I kind of thought they could have done a little better at that. So a little bit about AM antennas. This was one that got torqued by a tornado last year and was online. It survived, but the fix on this, there is no fix. There's just no fix. How long is it going to stand up? That's going to be the question. Well, I don't know. So you need to be prepared for these kinds of situations. The lightning protection of any AM tower begins at the base with the ball gaps. Now this looks like a pretty standard setup. And these are fairly old set of ball gaps, and they look like they're set correctly for, maybe 5 kilowatt station. But there is no arcing that has occurred between them. They look in really good shape. So a typical inspection, you say, oh yeah, they look in good shape. Well, they're in good shape because this ground is insulated by the rust, and the mount for the ball is insulated by the rust and the rusty hardware here. So there is no connection between this ball and that ground strap to speak of. Otherwise, you would see a lot of arc marks in between there. So on the first glance, it looks in fine shape, but it is a sacrificial piece of equipment. There should be arc marks and spark marks in here. Also, because even if this strap was moved over and tied off to the lower ball properly, you can't be assured that an AM field is a proper ground for lightning. It's at the wrong frequency. It's tuned to your operating frequency when you build this big AM field. You need to drive 8 to 10 foot ground rods here at the base and nail that down to that strap, which is coming over to this Johnny ball. So when the lightning comes down the tower, it goes into the ground, not out into the ground system. Here's another set of Johnny ball or ball gap. And unless this is about a 50 kilowatt station, they're set just a bit too far apart. So spacing on it, and what a lot of you guys I know do is you modulate the transmitter at 110% and go out with a hammer and tap on it until you start to see the arcing and then tap it back. And that's a good way to set them. But one piece of preventative equipment that I've run into on several sites are these horn gaps. And you put these inside the antenna tuning unit right after the feed from the tower. So you've got it in the tuning unit providing further protection to ground for lightning. You can also put these in your phaser too. So it's at the other end of the transmission line back in the building, and every feed line that comes up into the phaser, it can have a horn gap sitting on it. I really like that Nautel actually puts a horn gap inside their AM transmitter, and you get in there with a feeler gauge to set it to proper distance. And I looked at that, and boy, that's 330 seconds. I mean, that's not much of a gap. But talking with Nautel and Jeff, that's proper, and it works well. So by just adding more of these spark gaps through your system, because you don't know exactly where the lightning potential is going to show up. You can try and diffuse it, you know, from damaging things. And this is one thing that disappeared for a while, and it was nice to see it come back again. For the top set of guy wires, you put either a resistor or an inductor across the Johnny balls. So they're a DC short, but not for AM. They're a high impedance for AM. So in high wind conditions, you can actually bleed off the static buildup before it starts crescending across the Johnny balls and causing the transmitter to trip out. Especially in a blizzard, I've seen that a lot, where you got heavy blowing snow and the Johnny balls start arcing, and then the transmitter just goes nuts. And I'm sure you've seen that, John Bauer. It just goes, and now what do? You're watching them spark and the transmitter's hopping all around. Well, especially the inductor. We put up numerous of those when I was a tower erector. And each site that we had, you know, put them in, they were happy when we got done. Now, you have to have a ground rod at the anchor to carry the current that these inductors are going to bring down. You don't want to run it through the ground anchor, the guy anchor. So you have a separate ground rod, which isn't typical for an AM guide tower. But it's just one of these little things you can do in advance to make your antenna more dependable. Now, a while back, I was asked to do an inspection on a tower, and they actually had a top load system where you're using the column as the radiator, and then they wanted to increase the frequency by using the first section of guy wires. It's called top load. So there was a jumper that was run from the leg of the tower over to the preformed guy grip. And I had never really seen that kind of a setup before, and I looked at them and I could see the rust, and I could see, you know, something was going on there, but the dots didn't quite connect. It was about a month later that a windstorm came through and it popped. What I had missed was underneath the cable clamp, there was actually corrosion going on. So if you have an AM tower, point of the story, an AM tower that's top loaded with the guy system, you want to jump past the preformed guy grip and get out to the cable to attach any jumper. Don't use the preform as a conduction point for that top loading. It's not easy to get to. You almost have to do it when the tower is built and the wires are slacked in, but it's the best way to do it. Having an emergency standby antenna for any AM plant is pretty easy to do, and we're all familiar, or a lot of us are familiar with how to create a matching network. But do we have the parts on hand? Do we have the poles in the ground on the site with the correct orientation for the pattern that we'd want to get off of it? Because if a major emergency comes through like did in Joplin and your tower's laying on the ground, well, the utility company's going to be a little busy to stop by and sink some poles on your site. You might get, you know, some tower people out there in a hurry, but if you have the poles in the ground and this long wire in a box, you cannot have it ready, you cannot have it built by the FCC rules, but you can have it ready to deploy. And am I understanding that right, Cliff?
I'd say you're right.
And then you want to, you know, the orientation between the two poles, because it's not an omnidirectional antenna. It's not going to cover 360. It's going to favor coming off the sides of it. So if your market, you know, is to the west, then you want to run it north-south. So you're going east and west. Several manufacturers can help with making up, you know, a nice box with a one kilowatt or 5 kilowatt system ready to go. And you have to gauge all your hardware commensurate with the power level. But again, having it ready to go for worst case is key. Here's a base insulator replacement on a Blount Ox tower that I saw on the web recently. And what they had to do here, this is a 1951-52 tower. You get cracks in the insulator. And then these old big self-supporters, you have to jack up and take out the insulator. And you can see this picture on the left was taken outside the fence, whereas this one's inside the fence, and they felt it was safe to go in there again. This shows a pretty solid methodology, but there really is no handbook on how to change out base insulators. So the rigger has to come up with his own methodology to safely do it for you. This particular methodology takes into account the downward pressure with the jacks. But if the wind came up and started pushing this tower over, there would be no way to stop it. Because this is a push-pull insulator right here, depending which way the wind is blowing. So yet this is a good method. You can't leave it in this way for very long, because if the wind shifts, the tower will come down. These both are Blount Ox towers that didn't survive windstorms over the last year. Certainly this scenario, because it's just completely down, is better than the scenario on the left. Because now you're going to have to talk somebody into going up there and dealing with this partial collapse. Which, that's when the riggers really make their money, I'll tell you. To move on to just other things that happened last year, this was a windstorm in South Carolina, this was a windstorm in northern Minnesota, and this was an ice storm in Reliance, South Dakota. Weather brings down towers all the time, apparently, and Dave Davies gave an excellent presentation a couple of years ago that yes, it may have been, appeared to have been ice, or it may have appeared to have been this or that. If you're ever caught in this kind of situation, you're going to get a ton of questions coming at you, and Ron Vista's going to talk a lot about this in the next presentation. But we are people of facts, and that's where we started this talk. It's just the facts. Well, at this point, how could it happen? What caused the tower to come down? When will we be back on the air? I mean, just a whole plethora. Oh, do you think the airplane sticking out on the pile on the ground has anything to do with the tower going down? Because we're factually based people, we want to come up with a real answer, because we're trying to collect a real answer. Having been involved in several tower collapses, I'll tell you the first thing that comes to your mind and has to stay in the forefront of your mind is this. That's what you know. Wow, what a mess. And as the questions come at you, you just keep repeating that, because the insurance company is going to hire professional engineers that will come in and tell you why the tower came down. Let them do that, and that's their job. Our jobs are to try to keep towers up. Once they hit the dirt, our job is over, as far as that tower goes. Our mission now is to get the station back online. And whatever created it, don't go there. Don't even speculate. Don't even say, well, yeah, it could have been the ice, it could have been the wind, it could have been anything. But that makes the station look bad, makes you look bad if you're wrong, and it also gives the insurance company a possible out on the claim. So anyways, ready? Repeat after me. Everybody, wow, what a mess. That's what comes to the forefront of your mind. So for FM antennas, backup antennas are a really great thing to have, but without periodically testing them, you're really not sure if it's a viable backup or not. In a multiple station system, you're best to have a standby antenna for in the basement, like Jay had. Had an outage at one site, we're able to go in the basement of the primary station, run it up to the location, cut the transmission line back, tune it up, and get on at low power. Lost, what did we lose, 6 hours, 7 hours? Pretty quick recovery, because you had that single bay. You know, it's access to parts in a hurry, and they have to be viable parts. I've seen sites where old antennas are in the weeds. We got a spare one around here. Oh, yeah, it's good for about 1 watt. Now you're trying to clean it and fix it and put it up and test it, and how long is it going to last? Proper pressurization is always the key to all of these antenna systems, and we'll look at a couple of small items that will keep us out of the woods for pressurization. A line adapter on site. If you got 3-inch line, 1 5/8, whatever size. If you have down to type N adapter or down to a DIN adapter, you can plug the exciter in and at least be back on the air with some power. Having an emergency tower plan is real key. So you know in advance what you think you're going to do next if the tower comes down. And then lastly, we'll talk about antenna de-icers a little bit. So Chris Tarr took this picture last winter, and this was the same ice storm that brought down the Eau Claire Tower, or apparently brought down the Eau Claire Tower. I won't go into that the ice was the factor. But Chris's de-icers were running, and they were on low power for, I think, 3 or 4 days. They just couldn't keep up. The ice was so severe. But you can clearly see the standby antenna right here and a nice big ice shield above it. And you can't even see the top of the tower. It's up in the fog. And this was down at the base of the tower. So as Dave talked about this morning, this ice accumulation occurs as greater as the elevation increases. I was doing an inspection recently on a site out in Los Angeles, and it's a pretty good installation, but you look at these anti-sway brackets that ERI sells with the antenna. They're there for a reason. They're there to take in the torsional pressure that the rototiller submits to the backbone of the antenna. Well, not only did the rigger not extend this over to the other leg or over to something on the tower properly, he just tied it back with some tape. I mean, that's, why bother? Why didn't you just take it off? Because eventually the tape's going to let go. This thing's going to start flapping around and hitting the antenna and falling off and hitting something else. This is where our role on the ground is important. We should look up, look at the print, get the binoculars out, and see, you know, is everything in place? They've also, for the de-icer harness, just taped it off. Now, this is at 6,000 feet, so 3-foot spacing on the tape off is a bit wide. They get some pretty nasty weather up there. Picking the size of the pressurization unit for your transmission line is critical. I've gone into sites with 3-inch, you know, 500 feet of 3-inch line, and they got one of these little guys over in the corner, and it's just working its heart out because it can't even keep up with trying to fill the line. This is made for maybe 100 feet of waveguide, small waveguide, or 7/8-inch line. This one here would be 1 5/8, 300 feet of 1 5/8. You know, the bigger the line, the bigger the pressurization you need to keep up with it. Because tight systems, they're tight to a point. They will breathe and they will require, you know, additional charging. One of my favorite cheap insurance devices is right here. You put this on in a T to the pressurization in the transmission line, and it goes back to the remote control. So you know immediately when that line drops below 2 pounds. So you can go out and do something about it. Actually, at the Sutro Tower in San Francisco, they have a nitrogen generator in the base of the transmitter building, and the manager of the tower site monitors everybody's pressurization because they know that lack of pressurization is the largest cause of outages. So by them monitoring all the tenants' pressurization, they can tell the tenant, you have a leak and you gotta fix it. And then they're sure that they did fix it. But this is a key, this is like $50. and that hooks back. This is a little more extravagant, made by Harris for regulators. You can go right into the regulator of the nitrogen tank and back to the remote control again. But staying on that, I've poured lots of water out of transmission lines or troubleshot, you know, outages that I can see the bump out there at the base of the tower on the TDR, and it's just lack of pressure that led to the water. Even with a good set of O-rings, if it's not under pressure, it's going to suck water. Remember this? This was really high tech. We thought we had entered the light speed, right, Cliff, when we had this on the receiver? Now, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. We were covering the city of license, but the exciter was really not happy with the match. So that gets back to this, having the right size transition on site. So when the main transmitter blows, then you can get the exciter into the antenna. As far as emergency tower procedures, the cell companies, again, have come up with some excellent ideas. They have subcontractors, and even some of the cell companies carry their own cell on wheels. But there are numerous contractors throughout the U.S. that you can have an account with already, an agreement with already, and your standby antenna sitting in the basement. So if your tower hits the dirt, you can call these boys up, and they'll send a hotshot driver, and one of these 100-foot crank-up towers will be in your yard in 12 hours. So you can throw an antenna on it and put it up, and okay, we're back on with something. It's a way to meet the need. They also have enclosures on them and generators, so if your site gets totally blown away, you could move to a different location for an interim time and get it back online. I understand that Clear Channel actually outfitted several of these cows and have them stationed around the U.S. now so they can answer the outages, but I've not seen one yet. I've just heard that they have put some together. Some of the basic principles on antenna de-icers. This is a Jampro antenna, and you can see this is inside the elements of the Calrod heaters. So you've got the positive elements and the negative elements, and the boom of the antenna are all equally heated with a parallel set of heaters back to the harness. Shively has an excellent manual that comes with their antenna on the de-icers, a primer about the devices, and the controlling system for it. They use a thermostat, which is right here. So it's temperature sensing that determines when the system comes on or off. Other systems will use what's called a sleet sensor. The advantage to the thermometer is that you have that on the ground where you can access it to service it. The sleet sensor is up by the antenna. Because by the time the ice gets down to a sleet sensor that's on the ground, your antenna is so iced up it's going to take weeks for it to catch up and actually thaw out again. I like this picture here because it just, you can share it with the rigger on showing him what you think done looks like as far as a clean wiring job. The only thing I would add, that any wire nut that's on your towers needs to be taped off. Because when lightning comes down, it likes to blow those wire nuts off, or water gets into them, and you get a resistive connection that then burns out. So as you discuss it with the riggers while you're doing work on these systems, because they're not electricians. We expect so much of our tower riggers. You're looking for a rough carpenter and a finished carpenter in the same person. I mean, you wouldn't have a rough carpenter hang your cabinets and expect it to come out right. But that's what we're asking of a tower worker. And a lot of them are very good at trying, but they're just not adept at all needs. Also in the Shively manual is a good readout on the current flow that you would expect to see in a good operating system. They got their models of antennas and the number of bays and how much current you would see on each leg of the supplied power. Also the resistance that you would expect to see on each leg. So like this time of year is a good time to check the current flow, check the resistance up to your de-icers to know that they're all in circuit, and then write it down in a log so you can see each year, because things are going to age. So it gives you an idea how the system's holding up. By the time the January, February ice storm comes, I'll tell you, as an ex-rigger, my biggest fear was people call it up and say, well, we got de-icer trouble. Well, first that means you're going to go up in wonderful conditions. And second, you're going to have to do it at night because unless they have a standby antenna, that's the only time they want to turn off. And working at 1,000 feet at 2 o'clock in February, 2 a.m. in the morning in February, it's really hard to do a good job. You're thinking about back down there. And you're looking down at the lights on the ground, and you know the engineer's inside, got his cup of coffee, got his laptop, and he's, you know, doing his thing. It's like, wow, I think I got the wrong line of work. Here's a partial view of the sleet sensor. I took the picture more to show the lead to the owner. The sleet sensor has a dome on it, a little probe on it, so as it collects ice, then it turns on the de-icers, and it's up near the antenna. But how long is this going to last? And you can't access it to repair it readily. You know, you get an ice storm and a piece of ice hits that, and now your de-icers are offline because you have no sensor. So you either have to manually run it with a contactor or find someone to go up there and fix that for you. This same antenna on, this is Mount Wilson again. We talk about ice shields. ERI makes these. It's called the Invisa Shield, is that what it's called, Dave? Yeah. You know, it's made out of fiberglass. And I can't tell you how many side-mounted antenna bays I've seen just smacked by ice so badly that, you know, they're not repairable at all. And this is a pretty good idea. You cannot use steel this close to a radiator without changing the radiation pattern of that antenna. So this is actually made out of fiberglass. Here's an ENG antenna that was very thankful to have an ice shield above it. You can see how deformed this is by the hits that it had taken, and this fiberglass radomed ENG antenna would have just been smashed. So that was just good, cheap insurance, but this is only a 300-foot tower. So the speed that was gained from 300 feet down to the roof level was significant. Now you take a 1,000-foot tower and drop a car-sized piece of ice off it, it's going to clean some things off. I was interested to note at the top of the tower, they have these runs of rigid line that go horizontally from the vertical run over to the antennas with no ice shielding on it at all. Anytime you've got flex lines or rigid lines that come out of the vertical plane and go into the horizontal plane, you've got to either tuck them in underneath the leg so you get the cross members to offer some protection, or you actually have an ice shield deck so they can't be smacked. Even in the best condition, though, some lines get hit. And you can see the dent in this one right here. I don't think it was ice. I think it was a wrench. The form of it looked more like a wrench. But you're trying to protect from anything falling down. And this had ice shielding and everything around it, but it still got through. During the DTV build-out, there was a lot of leg-mount antennas that were purchased. Light and wind load and economy and get the station, you know, digital signal on the air. And what it is a branch-fed flex line system, and most of them have a rigid line coming to a power divider. This is just an example of one. I see a number of these, and there were several after the storm that hit the Eau Claire Tower that just tore up these flex line systems because there wasn't enough ice shielding up in the tower. This came down from 900-foot level on a tower in Minnesota. And you can see where the ice dented it right there, and that put the station off the air with that dent. So it's one of these flex line side mount antennas, like the FM. So anything that's side mounted is susceptible to being hit, and any kind of transmission lines that go into the horizontal plane are susceptible to being damaged. And these are just some areas to attend to in advance of the winter. Rigid lines put up with the worst weather. I mean, 2,000 feet, a 6-inch rigid line. It's going to expand and contract almost a foot and a half through the seasonal changes. It's going to change length by that much. And I got to give the manufacturers credit because they build a really robust product that can actually put up with that. Most of the burnouts that I've run into on rigid line systems happen in the fall because that's when we get our biggest swings in temperature in a 24-hour period. So I went through the Farmer's Almanac. This is for Madison, Wisconsin, last year. And you can see on this day right here, 31st of October, we had a 37-degree shift in a 24-hour period. So that means the rigid lines over on that candelabra tower in that 12-hour period were like a lung breathing as they expanded and contracted. We had another incident right here where it was a 36-degree shift in a 24-hour period. And, gee, what's right here in November, in the first week of November, Chuck? Sweeps, right? The worst time to have an outage. So we expect a lot of our rigid lines, and inspecting them and taking care of them is important, because this is the time of year when they will fail, if they're going to fail. If you make it through the fall, then they'll usually make the winter, and so on. Here's in Minneapolis in the same time period, a 30-degree shift and a 35-degree shift in a 24-hour period. Omaha was quite surprising, a 40-degree shift and a 43-degree shift and a 30-degree shift. And you can see how far apart the high of the day and the low of the day is. And as the winter comes along, that gradient tends to pull together. So these are the times that your rigid lines could really can fail if they're going to fail. And the component that takes the most work in a rigid transmission line is this watchman spring that's on the back half of the bullet. Here's the bullet. And then behind that, to make the connection to the inner conductor, is a watchman spring. This is a 15-year component. Now, I will give this piece of line credit. This went up in 1980. And that watchman spring looks excellent. But as time has gone on, products have been lessened in their robustness. I'll just leave it at that. You can see where the watchman spring is chewing away on the inside of the inner conductor here as this expansion and contraction is occurring throughout the year. But that is a 15-year component. We're reaching a point in some of the lines that went up in the digital transition. We're at 10 years on our lines. I know it just seems like yesterday we went through that craziness. Here's a station that I work with every year. In 2006, I hooked the network analyzer up. This is 100 megahertz wide pulse in the time domain. You can see all the bullets up this 1,200-foot run. Here it is in 2011. You can see the difference in those bullets. They are aging. The grass grew. I mean, we'll go back to this. This is the same scale, same test exactly, done 5 years apart. So the watchman springs in that system are starting to age, and there will reach a point where we'll need to rebuild that system before it fails. I actually had a call in a major market where these guys were running 120 kilowatts up a 9-inch line, and the studio called, and this was in the fall, studio called to say, we can't see you anymore. Are we still on the air? Oh yeah, we're full power, no problem. And the watchman springs had gone out on that line run, and their directional coupler was set inappropriately, so it wasn't seeing the reflected power, it was seeing a little bit of the forward power. But here we are in a major market, and they're not changing the watchman springs. This was some 25-year-old line. Ended up with the whole 1,000-foot run was junk. And going into the winter, into sweeps, just worst-case scenario. So a couple of final points. As our industry grows, there's some pilots that came out with a new way to set up a tower collision avoidance system. They're selling this to wind farms and tall tower owners. You actually turn the lights off on the tower until R2-D2 here, who mounts on the side of the windmill pipe or the tower, has a low-level radar in it. When it detects an aircraft coming, it turns the tower lights on. And then it's got a VHF whip right here. So on the emergency frequency for the aircraft, it starts yelling at them to warn that they're on a collision course with a tower. And I think that's an interesting advancement of collision avoidance. I've always felt the tower lights were somewhat limited in their ability to avoid collisions. And then finally, I don't know if any of you saw that program, Tower Dogs, that was on TV a couple of years ago. It really put the riggers in a bad light. They were in the bar in the first 10 minutes of the show. I mean, showing everybody boozing it up. But Mike Rowe, who does the Dirty Jobs show, and he does a pretty stellar job of working with people in different avocations, went out to Sioux Falls Tower, Kevin Reske right here. And Mike Rowe hooked up with him and spent time stacking a tower. And Vicki, you would appreciate that. You know, you're just trying to show these people as people. And that's what you did with the articles that you wrote, which were excellent. So that's all I have. Is there any questions?
Rich, what do you think of the sleet sensor up top? Is it standard procedure to add a bypass switch down below so in case that sensor does fail, you can get de-icers active again?
Yes, it would have a bypass switch. That was an RCA design that came out with that sleet sensor, and other people used it. And yes, there would be a bypass switch, but once you're already seeing the Vizoir go up, unless you're right on it, it's going to be hours, if not days, to catch back up with how much has accumulated already.
Up on the old 94.9 tower, we used to have a current meter, didn't we, that showed de-icer current years ago?
Right.
Was there a switch for that, or did you just turn it on when it got cold out?
When we thought an event was coming, we would turn it on. And then the people at the studio, if they remembered, would turn it off. So the de-icers would run for days and days that they didn't need to. And it was strictly a manual system.
Yeah, okay.
But we could see the current, and we knew, you know, if all the elements were in circuit.
I remember that. Thanks.
Yes, Mr. Dell.
Yeah, the watch band springs, when you were showing the inner wearing on those, I realize the watch band springs have to be replaced periodically, but is there any ratio to how long it is before you actually end up having to replace the inners? I would assume they wear out at that spot eventually.
Yeah, when should you shotgun the inners? You have to get in there with almost a micrometer to say, you know, how much is gone, how much material, you know. You could see the wear mark. But you could also note that there wasn't a lot of buildup on the brass plug underneath that. So there wasn't that much material that was mitigated, but it was just worn. So the spring was doing its job, and it's being sacrificed through that wear. But a total rebuild would be to just shotgun the inners, and that's another way to approach that. Well, thank you very much.